So tonight's discussion, which we've been discussing, is about the nature of unpleasant. And so I'd like to go in at this at a little different angle than you probably hear it usually, and which for some of you may be foreign, and for some of you may be controversial. But for me, the starting place in considering anything at all about this practice, and if I drop my voice and you can't hear it, you know, raise your hand, is the fact that what we're doing in this practice fundamentally is a training of attention. And this quotation from the historical Buddha that he knew of no other single thing so conducive to misery than an untrained mind, and that he knew of no other single thing so conducive to satisfaction and happiness than a well-trained mind. And so that is all about an experiential way of seeing into our experience, and I think it's helpful, particularly on this topic, and understanding, you know, most everyone here has heard the term of dependent origination, but this model that several of you have mentioned, where there is, at least when we can begin to see it, a feeling tone to experience, and then depending on how we respond to that feeling tone, that escalates up into desire or aversion, and depending on what we do with that, it escalates up into attachment, and depending on what we do with that, it escalates up into identification. And all of those are energetic states, which you can just hear from that, are a progressive contraction of the mind around some object, you know, a thought, a belief, a perception, a physical object, a person, an imaginary belief. It doesn't matter what it is, but that the mind is holding it, and then this energetic thing happens, and so the question becomes, well, what is suffering? And you could hear just from the group that there is the common idea that this level of contraction has to get to a certain point before, from a Buddhist perspective, it is considered suffering, right? And everybody could feel that, hear that in the room. And I think it felt like the general idea in the room was is that if something was unpleasant from the standpoint of an initial feeling tone of experience, pleasant or unpleasant or neutral, that it was not suffering. That felt like, to me, what the general consensus in the room was. So in looking at that, I think it's really helpful to understand that the original description of suffering came in multiple parts from the historical Buddha, and one of them was that all conditioned experience is unsatisfactory, and because it is unsatisfactory, all conditioned experience is suffering. And conditioned experience is experience that is based on the conditions that precede it and arise, and then the conditions that precede it color it. Okay. And the Buddha said that the biggest of those conditions, whether or not we're consciously recognizing it, but the mind knows it, is the complete conditionality of our lives and our experience. And that fundamental base makes all conditioned experience unsatisfactory and all conditioned experience suffering. Okay. So where does unpleasant come from? I mean, I think this is a fascinating question, because you could even hear from the discussion in the room that the idea kind of is, let's assume that the mallet is something happens, this is it, and then I have a reaction to this of unpleasant, and so unpleasant is somehow coming either after this event or simultaneous with it, and it's true that it's coming simultaneously with it, but it's like it's dependent on something out there or my reaction to it. That is not the Buddhist explanation of how unpleasant arises. The Buddhist explanation is that we have habits, beliefs, opinions, very deep emotional attachments that are called sankharas or mental formations. It doesn't matter what they're called. The basic idea is that we have had a host of prior experiences, including trauma, including having a series of life experiences that have made us averse to certain things. And so that when an experience arises at a sense door, you know, our eye, our ear, a particular thought in our mind, that simultaneously with that consciousness arises, and that that consciousness is colored. This feeling tone is colored, and it's colored by all of these, this reservoir of things that are in our body and our mind, which the Buddha called knots. He actually said that there are these knots in our mind, in our body, and that just given the right stimulus, those express themselves. And the earliest place they express themselves is in coloring the initial tone of our experience of pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. So from this perspective that I've just laid out, unpleasant is a form of suffering because it is an initial expression of experience being unsatisfactory in some way, because you can just hear from the paradigm that the mind's making a choice, is probably the wrong word, but it's not, well, everything is unpleasant. It's not that everything is unpleasant or that everything is neutral. There's three things going on. And two of the three have very distinct consequences. Is everybody getting this so far? So, if you accept this as a premise, that all conditioned experience is a form of suffering, I think that this helps define what I believe that the historical Buddha was trying to say about this model of dependent origination, or this model of how we move from an event or a thought to identification and suffering. And this idea that there is a progressive constriction, and at some point it becomes a holding, and then it becomes an identification, and at identification, we basically go unconscious, right? This is what we know. So, unpleasant is frequently taught as being something that is so subtle that you almost can't notice it. And I think generally speaking, because this is a training and because we are not trained in this culture to pay attention in all the ways we're trying to pay attention in this practice, but we're particularly not trained to somehow identify when something is just unpleasant as opposed to a desire. And you could hear some of the descriptions over on this side of the room in response to a question about unpleasant, really talking about desire, which is the intensification of pleasant and a constriction of that energy. Okay? So we're just not trained to watch and observe and experience and feel for unpleasant. But if you look at desire and aversion, attachment and identification, and just think about your own experience, each one of those discreetly is a range or a scope or a spectrum. It's not like there's just this, okay, now I'm feeling desire, you know. It's this whole range of, well, yeah, I kind of like that too. Boy, I really like that, you know. And then, you know, attachment is, I just don't like it. I mean, like, I need it. And that can go from, well, I need it, to, well, I really need it. And identification is, you're not even thinking you need it anymore. It's, you know, it's that I'm only going to have one piece of pie. And at the third piece of pie, you wake up and you realize that, you know, you're on the third piece of pie. So each one of those is a range. And to the degree that we can both conceptualize it, I think it's very important in terms of practice to have a conceptual model of what, how this all fits together. And then testing our experience about all these Dharma talks and books and the suttas we read. Well, what do they actually mean in terms of my experience? Because that's the bottom line, right? So, is it true? I mean, test it out. Is it true that there is a range of desire and there's a range of aversion? You know, like, I'm kind of annoyed. You know, like, I'm kind of annoyed about one of the answers that we're given over here. And actually, I'm really pissed off about one of the answers back there. Well, so, I mean, like, just test it out. Is that true or not? You know, is there this range? And with attachment, in terms of holding on, you know, I always like the one where the distinction I always like is you're right in the middle of an argument. And you realize right in the middle of it that what you've been arguing is bogus. Or is flawed. Okay? But you can feel, I mean, you can feel that hold, like, I don't want to give up my position. Right? But you see that, and you can say, okay, well, I have to concede, that, and you back out of it. And then there is the situation where right in the middle of it, you recognize it's bogus, and you can't stop yourself, and you keep arguing the position. You know, that's really into identification. You know, there's some piece of you, the attachment is like right at the edge, but then it lops over into identification. It's like, no, it's my position, and I'm not backing off. So, to the degree that we understand that each one of these is a spectrum, and then actually start watching our experience in the sense of there being a spectrum in each one of these, and our capacity to respond depends upon where we are on that spectrum. And we use different tools from a meditative and mindfulness perspective at different levels. You know, I think everybody's heard the little schematic that the Buddha set up on thinking, you know, and he said that there's five techniques you can use for dealing with difficult thinking. And the first one is, you know, you see some trouble, some thinking, let's say it's self-judgment, so that you flip it on itself and you use a thought that's very positive about yourself that you know to be true. You know, it's not like you're making it up to feel better. No, I mean, it's actually true, you know, that in certain circumstances, I'm a really compassionate person. So in this circumstance, you know, that was pretty nasty, what I just said, you know, got the better of me. And so, you know, you flip that to balance the energy in your mind so it doesn't take you down into serious self-judgment and criticism and depression. So that's the first one. The last one is, the Buddha says, and this is like for like really kind of like terminally problematic thinking. He says, you know, what you do is you grit your teeth and you use all the force that you have and just say, no, I'm not going there. And it's one of the few places that you will find in any of the suttas where the Buddha actually talks about force. And the illustration that he uses is of a larger man subduing a smaller man and sitting on top of him. And, you know, you don't hear those kinds of little pictures. The Buddha almost never uses that either. But you can just hear from that, like, there's a range of response, right? Depending on how strong your mind is, the quality of the mindfulness that is present, your skill level in terms of how long you've been practicing and then the particular thing that you're dealing with. You know, we may be terribly skilled at dealing with one particular negative state of mind because we've been working on it. When we get to a level of practice and it's, you know, opens up and we realize that there's another whole mind state that is behind that mind state that we're not skilled at dealing with, and we don't have very good skills, you know. So we've got to acknowledge that and adjust how we approach that. I mean, you know, so for years, when I was first practicing, I thought that my problem was that I was an angry person. And I was. And then I kind of got a hold of that, and then when I started, you know, the fundamental process here is you just keep watching that, right? And how, what causes it to arise and sustain, and just keep watching it. And then what I realized is that while I was an angry person, that really wasn't the issue. The issue was is that I was a really depressed person, and that the anger was my way of masking and defending against the depression. Okay, and then I realized I didn't have any skill set at all. I'd become like really good at, first of all, at managing anger with all of these tools, and then progressively seeing into its working in my mind and my life. And then once I kind of broke through that, it was like, wow, you know, like I certainly, of course, had the inkling, you know, and knew that there were times when I got depressed, but I realized that I was depressed all the time. And I didn't know that. It's like a shocking thing, you know. And I realized that my skill set was deficient. That on that particular thing, I didn't have the skill set that I had with anger. And I had to acknowledge that. And you know, practice gives you a lot of humility, right? It's like, no, I've got to go way back on this. And start just as I did on anger. You know, and I think if you talk with anybody who's practiced for any period of time, they'll report this kind of thing to you because the practice just keeps opening you up to layer after layer after layer after layer. And it's true that, you know, you've got this generalized set of skills that you can apply, but this general principle about there's something powerful sitting there that you haven't worked with before in this way is still present, you know. So I think to the degree that, you know, let's just work on desire and aversion, attachment, identification forward, to the degree that we can understand each one of these being like a big spectrum and exploring that to see if it's true, I mean, like with some curiosity and discovery, the possibility of our practice opening up in terms of how we understand the difficult mind states that trouble us suddenly really expands. Because in the same way that we develop an idea of what we think we know something to be or someone to be, much bigger than that. Whatever this little constricted idea that has formulated in our mind. And so to the degree that we are willing to not hold on to that, which is just, in my opinion, from a practice standpoint, one of the most unseen and most troubling forms of attachment. It's like, oh, I know what anger is. Well, I know what anger is, what I think it is, based on my experience to this point. And that experience may not have allowed a much bigger understanding of anger depending on the way you investigated it, because we're so defended against negative mind states. So what I'm encouraging here is just to consider the possibility that whatever you think about whatever your favorite troubling state of mind is may be wrong, in the sense that what you already know is true, but that you become attached to seeing whatever that is through a certain prism, and that it's much bigger than that, and the bigger that you are able to understand it experientially, the greater the possibility of lessening your suffering. Because the end game of this practice isn't just to manage stuff. It's to see into its true nature and be liberated from it. So if you just think about how you're dealing with, you know, whatever it is, and the honest answer is I'm just managing it. That's actually what I'm doing with my mindfulness and my meditation practice. Almost assuredly, there is an attachment to way of seeing that is limiting your ability to work with it. Everybody get that? Okay. Like if you look at, you know, just think about the thing that has been troubling you for years. My guess is there's not a single person in this room who doesn't have some issue that they've been dealing with for years or their whole life, and they're still dealing with it. And if you honestly look at that, and basically what you're doing is just like managing it when it comes up, almost assuredly you are attached to understanding it in a certain way and understanding of how to work with it, with this practice in a particular way. And whenever there's an attachment, there's a limitation. So to the degree that you can just like watch that, investigate that. Like, is that true or not? You know, is what I'm really doing just managing it or not? Because a lot of times we think that we have kind of like solved the problem. That's what our mind says. And the reason we think that is because when it comes up, we figured out how to dampen it down. But that doesn't mean that we've uprooted it or eliminated it. So I think this is a rich area for investigation and exploration. So that takes me back to the step before that, desire and aversion. And as I said, you know, the way that you normally hear pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral taught is that it's this very subtle initial feeling tone. And I actually think that it's something more than that. I think that there is a range, in the same way that there's a range of desire, and there's a range of attachment, and a range of identification, I believe there is a range of pleasant and unpleasant. And part of the reason I believe this is because I've been doing so much work with pain, because I've realized, which I may have intellectually understood before, but I didn't understand it experientially, and I've had this great workshop in the past couple of years to work with my own pain, is that you can actually have quite intense sensation in your body, and it is not pain. In fact, it's not even uncomfortable. In fact, it's not even unpleasant.
Now, if you just drop the on.
Yeah. You know, like if you talk with most people who work in pain on a daily basis and say that to them, they have no idea what you're talking about because they don't believe that that's possible. But I'm absolutely convinced of it through my own experience. And this has, in part, helped me re-envision my own understanding of unpleasant and neutral and pleasant. Pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, those three. So I actually believe that unpleasant is a range. And that pleasant before desire is a range. And that neutral, what we call neutral, which may not be a good translation, but it is an experience that does not have the tone of pleasant or unpleasant to it. And you can have very intense sensation in the body and it still be in that neutral range. It's not triggering pleasant or unpleasant. So, if that's true, that you can have intense sensation that remains neutral, that for most people is a startling idea. And for most people, the idea that you can have an intense sensation in your body, and it's merely unpleasant, it's not aversive, is equally challenging. I mean, we may be able to hear that experientially, but, you know, next time you stub your toe or something, you know. So I'm convinced, and I'm not asking you to accept this, because all of this is about, okay, try this out for yourself. But my suggestion is to really look at this, because if any of this is true, that this actually is a range, the possibility of expanding how we understand our ability to work with sensation in a body-based practice suddenly telescopes out. And concurrently with that, the possibility of reducing the depth or intensity of our suffering happens at the same time. With my own pain and with chronic pain patients, just getting people to adopt a model for experimentation that there is neutral, unpleasant, uncomfortable, and then pain. And just not believe that, just test it out, okay? You know, so you're sitting in your hospital bed, you've had this surgery, what is it? I mean, okay, you're feeling something in your leg. Is that neutral? Is it unpleasant? Is it uncomfortable? Or is it pain? And after a while, just the possibility that that is true and investigating it starts to change your perception of your experiencing in your body, because you've expanded out the conceptual model. You know, before it was like, well, you know, there's pain is 1 to 10 and then everything else before pain. But, you know, there's no gradation of what happens before pain. So then I have an intense sensation, and what is it? Well, it's pain. And then people start to see that they have a very intense sensation and it actually is not pain. It's really unpleasant. It may be really uncomfortable, but it doesn't rise up to the level of being painful. And to the degree that a person is able to do that, their entire idea of the experience of pain and how they're experiencing pain radically changes. And although it's not worded the way I'm wording it, that's what the entire University of Massachusetts mindfulness-based stress reduction program is on, is reconceptualizing your experience of pain. And that is, you know, radically experiential. So this is my way of trying to describe my experience and how one can understand that program in a different way. But you see people go through that UMass program and, you know, good MBSR teachers. I mean, where the course is actually on pain. You know, MBSR now has become so popular, it's being offered in wellness programs. You know, it's like a wellness thing. Well, I'm talking about MBSR as a pain program. And you talk with anybody who's gone through a really good MBSR program for pain with a skilled teacher, and they will tell you that their whole understanding of pain has changed. And it's gone from them holding pain in an attached margin to this expanded idea, and because there is now this whole new space of defining sensation in your body, they're suffering less and they're experiencing less pain in their life. So this whole idea of everything in practice, you know, and every negative mindset being on a spectrum and investigating that, for me, has become, in the last several years, kind of a touchstone of my practice. And I feel like it's changed my practice.
No, I have one comment, because normally when people face the pain, great pain, the common response is the people want to get out of the situation, get out of the situation as soon as possible.
Of course.
So this kind of the bottleneck, because when we are in that, they might say, I want to get out of the situation right now. I want to get out of the situation as soon as possible. So then we don't have a chance to moving forward.
That's right.
So to me is this mindset, I want to get out of the situation as soon as possible. That's my bottleneck. If I can overcome that bottleneck, I can continue. So how can we get out of this mindset? I want to get out of the situation right away. How can we get out this kind of mindset?
Oh, there's a simple answer to that. But I mean, this is the core human dilemma, right? The Buddha was pointing at, because I mean, like, well, what's, you know, the generalized definition of vipassana is seeing clearly, you know, of being willing to be present with whatever is there without changing it, without managing it, without doing anything about it, just staying there and watching it, and through that experience seeing how it arises, how it's sustained and passed away. That's the model, right? And that's the reason that the Buddha said this: we would always be swimming upstream. Because if you say, well, with pain people want to get out of it, listen, with the smallest level of discomfort or unpleasantness, we want to get out of it. I mean, like, sitting up here, you're always watching for, like, what's happening out there, right? Like, you know, how often people are moving, the expressions on their face, are they really paying attention? And one thing when you're sitting up here that you see a lot of is this. You know, this is what you don't see for 45 minutes. You don't see that. What you see is this, you see. And almost all of that is going on, and people don't know they're doing it. You know, so the smallest little level of unpleasantness or discomfort, we are conditioned, like, not to be with it.
Well, no one's left yet, so.
Excuse me?
I said, well, no one's left yet.
That's good. I'll take that. But I mean, this is the habit of mind, is to avoid what is unpleasant or uncomfortable. And in the Honeyball Sutta, the Buddha was very clear that if it's discomfort in the body, that the mind will almost automatically, I mean, its conditioned response is to go into thinking, mm-hmm. not to feel in the body.
Unless you have some undertones of, well, the Catholic way, that really suffering and pain.
You know, the Catholics are over at.
Run for nails, your bed.
But talking about the Catholics, though, you know, the popes in the country, and there was a big celebration tonight. You know, something to do with families, and they selected 30 high school students from all around the United States who wrote essays of why I would want to have dinner with the Pope.
An interview?
Why I would want to have dinner.
Dinner.
Okay. And then they have this big dinner tonight, and it's those 30 high school students and their families. And they flew them all back to Philadelphia. And one of those 30 is from here in Sacramento. It's the daughter of one of my best friends.
Wow.
Yeah, so like for them, I mean, like, top of the world, right? I mean, like, couldn't get much bigger than that, you know? I mean, like, I keep saying I'd love to have dinner with the Buddha. I don't think it's going to happen, you know?
So. Have you written an essay?
Maybe that's... Okay, so I was going to say a number of other things, but we started questions and we've got a few minutes, so yeah. For being a newbie and not knowing this, you're doing really good.
I wanted to share one thing that happened to me about how I reacted to like what my body was telling me and changed how I thought about it. And it was one day when I was when it was raining really hard, it was really cold. I was over at Sacramento City College. I didn't have a jacket, and I was shivering and I was walking along, and then I just realized that how I'm reacting to this experience is like completely within my mind. It's like I'm not gonna die because of this cold, and so I just stopped. I took my hands off my head, and I like stopped punching up my shoulders. I just relaxed and I looked up, let the rain hit my face. I looked around. It was beautiful. It was amazing out. And I haven't had a problem with cold or anything since then. I just take myself back to that experience. And now I just like, I walk around and I'm fine. And it's amazing. So I think if you start small with things like that it'll make it easier to do that when something worse happens. Yeah. You know, something less pleasant.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thank you. That's a fantastic story. You know, and it illustrates this fundamental idea that for all of us with all this education we have, we lost the ability to do that, you know, because we know what the answer is, we know what our experience is, we know what mind states are, and what this whole practice is trying to do is undermine all of that. Undermine all of us being attached to understanding cold in a particular way and hot in a particular way and what have you, you know. Like we go on this pilgrimage, and people will say, you know, I'm terrified to go on the pilgrimage because it's so hot and I have this whole issue with heat and what have you, and which for many people is real. And having said that, the very fact of conceptualizing in that way locks you into not experimenting beyond some very narrow windows. And so when the way I was taught at UMass to run an MBSR course was the first night, one of the features of it is you get everybody and you have a circle and everybody, it's the one night where everybody gets to tell their story. And if it's a chronic pain course, I mean, it's powerful stuff. I mean, the stories people have are, you know, and the traumatic experiences associated with pain. And so you go through like lots of Kleenex tissue, and it's real, very, very bonding. So you let everybody go through that, and then you say, okay, well, I'm going to say something now that may be the single most important thing I'm going to say in this entire course, which after an evening like that usually gets people's attention. You know, okay, he's going to say something. You know, you say, okay, I really want to honor the story that everybody just told and how powerful that is in your lives. And then I want everyone in this room to realize that that story may be the biggest obstacle that you have in your life to dealing with your pain. Mm-hmm. That's how it starts. That's how that course starts, you know. So, so we just, you know, our minds, they are habituated to locking on to things and then holding on to that. I mean, I think it's biological, right? I mean, like, we look at something and our mind is trying to put it into a box and to associate it with something else so we know what it is, so we know how to deal with it, and we feel safe. I mean, it's a biological imperative. So then that biological imperative just extends out to everything else. So the reason I started with the quotation about training from the Buddha is that actually if you think of that quotation as a retraining quotation, it's what we're talking about. I mean, we're really retraining the mind out of these habits which keep us locked in certain perspectives of the world which cause us to suffer. You know, You know, the first noble truth is not that all experience is suffering, because we can be liberated from suffering. It's that the normal way that the human mind engages and perceives experience causes it to suffer. So, okay, any other questions, comments, arguments?
No doubt some of you have run across an interesting woman. Years ago, I went down to Barstow and studied with Byron Katie, whose bottom line, I still have her bumper sticker, "Who would you be without your story?"
Yeah. Probably not suffering.
And something that doesn't necessarily fit in here, but it's something I've been doing lately, just as a real low-key, finding gentle ways to sort of bring it in. And I have just been so amazed that people are so angry and they don't want to think about it. How the world at large, media, newspapers, et cetera, has a level of control. It's like, no, I control my own life. Okay? But I've had to really think, boy, a lot of people just don't even want to consider.
I thought at the beginning of this. That at the beginning of the discussion, you were saying that the feeling tones of pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral were all suffering in classic Buddhist sense. So I'm kind of struggling with neutral as a suffering.
Yeah. If I said that, I didn't mean to say that.
So, okay. And so what? If you are truly feeling neutral about something, then there's no suffering.
Well, the idea is that the seed of aversion and attachment and identification is in unpleasant.
Right.
And the seed of desire is in pleasant. Okay. Where a seed like that is not in neutral.
Okay.
Yeah, it's not generating a feeling tone. So neutral by itself doesn't escalate up into something in the sense of this chain.
Right. There's nothing to attach to.
Yeah.
The other question, which is totally out of the direction, is aversion can have a very practical function in keeping yourself alive.
Absolutely.
So it's a question of understanding when that's an appropriate aversion, I guess, versus that instinctive. I understood very much that story about responding to cold the way you know you're supposed to respond to cold, and then if you relax into it, you're actually. It's wonderful. So there's that aversion that is important.
I think it has its practical implications, but from the standpoint of like where we're trying to go, we're trying to diminish the influence of attachment, identification, and aversion and pleasure to the degree that they become harmful to us. Okay, and so in the classical the idea that we have to have aversion in order to see wisely to protect ourselves, would be like dualistic thinking, right?
Right.
Because if we just watch our experience in this model, we begin to see what leads to hurting ourselves and what doesn't, and what leads to protecting ourselves and what doesn't. And what we want is we want more and more for our life to be guided by that wisdom as opposed to being driven by aversion or desire. You follow me?
Yeah.
So the mind, when we talk about purification, we slowly start to purify the mind of the mind states that tend to just drive us, and we're relying on the wisdom piece to see clearly as to what is skillful to do. Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. So, all right, well, I'd like to thank everyone for coming. I hope you found this an interesting evening. I did. Yeah, I'm serious. I mean, like, you know, to hear all the voices, and then also for me, like, for tonight, I mean, like, a lot of wisdom in this room, you know. A lot of wisdom in the room. It's very, very exciting. So may our effort to understand these teachings and put them together in our life and the value of that not only enrich our lives, but everyone around us, ripple out into the community and hopefully into the rest of the world. And with the amount of suffering that we have in the world right now, you know, we could start listing it off and go until next Thursday. You know, it's extraordinary. And so may our efforts in some really very clear and tangible way contribute to a lessening of suffering in the world. Okay, so thank you very much.
Thank you.